Okay, it's February 26th, 2009. I'm sitting with Bernie Melman. Mr. Melman, can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in 1924 in Columbus, Ohio. I'm a Buckeye.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had a younger sister and an older sister, Rosalie and Kathleen, and my sister Kathleen died at the young age of 39. Unfortunately, she was living in Dallas, Texas, and one of the sad weekends of my life when we went down to bring her to rest. She was just getting ready, just off the record. You want me just to, you know, you tell me when to stop.
Go ahead.
Off the record. Well, what happened, we were all preparing. In our religion, when a boy gets to be 13 years old, he goes through a bar mitzvah. And he was just studying and getting all prepped to do that. And the whole family flew down to Dallas, Texas. And after we came home, Kathleen had some kind of a stroke. There was something in her digestive tract that exploded, and the kids found her when they got home from school. So she passed away at the young age of 30, something like that. That way. The older sister made it to about 80 something. Rosalie, her husband Jack was the 88th Air Blue Devil Division in Italy. He served 3 years in the service.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was back, this has got to be back in the 30s. And up till the turn of the 30s to the 40s, he was basically self-employed. He had a used car lot, sold parts. He had used parts. He sold, he put window glass into cars. And those days back in the 30s, they had a straight glass, you know, they could break. And he could repair and replace cars that needed new windows, door windows and so forth. And he did that. He actually was operating right across the street from Bob Chevrolet, and I remember that, on Parsons Avenue in the Columbus. And that's where he operated, and the boys at Bob Chevrolet, they liked him, and they treated Ike, that's what his name was, Isaac, they liked him and they treated him well, and that's why I used to go to visit him down at the building he had. He had a nice warehouse there.
Can you tell me a little bit about growing up in Columbus?
Yeah, born in 1924, I'm of the Jewish faith, so I had the circumcision and all the stuff that goes with it. Back in Columbus, Ohio, I was born in that city, back in 1924, and I had a bunch of good friends, always had a lot of boyfriends. The girls didn't come into the picture yet. And we moved from Fulton Street to Carpenter Avenue, and that's where I grew up. And Ohio Avenue School was my elementary school, and we lived about 3-4 blocks. And we always went to school with our whole was about 6-7 of us in our crowd, and we grew up pretty well. And then the 30s came along, and I went through my 13th birthday in 1937, and that was a big affair for my family when I became this bar mitzvah, and it's a big weekend for that time, and 37, and in 39 I was graduating from high school. That's when my military career got started.
How did that start?
Well, It really started because in 1939, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor?
1941.
It was December 7th, I think. Yeah, 1941. I was attending a social group, boys and girls, and it was on December 7th, 1941, and everybody was talking away about Pearl Harbor. And I was just 17 years old, December 1941, and I just remember that that's all we talked about. What, can you imagine how the Japanese people came with their planes out of nowhere and killed our American friends, our soldiers, the Navy especially, in Pearl Harbor. And that was the topic of the conversation for that day. And of course, in the next few days, it was really the airwaves were, we didn't have television at that time, but everything was by the radio. And of course, the President Roosevelt was all over the radio talking about Pearl Harbor and what we're going to do about it. And the United States declared a war on Japan, and at the same time he declared war on Germany, because actually we were helping Germany at the time and helping England against Germany at the time. We were not involved yet, but we were supplying them with weapons, and we were supplying them with ships were going over, giving to help the British, who were already in a struggle with the German people. And that was December 7th, 1941. And I graduated from high school in 1942. Mm-hmm. And I decided, the war's on. And I was already going to starting at Ohio State. And I thought, I really should join the ROTC, Reserve Officer Training School. And it happened that Ohio State at the time had the artillery portion of the service. That's what they were training at Columbus, Ohio. And I thought, that's good to learn a little, get familiar with the military, because when I started at Ohio State in 42, not all my friends, I was still 17 years old, I hadn't been turned 18 yet, but some of my older friends, I lost two friends who volunteered in Canada to go fly. And they were older, a couple years older, but they were friends from school. And they both got shot down. So I probably, you're bringing me into memory, and you'll see parts of it I'm going to break up again. But don't let it bother you. I've lived through this. And when I go into the memory, that's the part that it gets to me. Because the greatest president that ever lived, as far as I'm concerned, was Franklin D. Roosevelt. And if you get a chance to learn it, you'll hear some of his old speeches. It got to me. He says, we shall win. Because after the Japanese destroyed some of our fleet in the Hawaiian Islands. So I started in September of 1942. I started at Ohio State as a freshman. I joined the ROTC because at that time I said, I don't want them to start in the middle of a course and they'll pull me out and draft me, because I'm going to turn 18, so I'm prime material. So I joined the ROTC, which that'll give me a deferment till the war is ended, because I'm going to be training in the military to become an officer. 17 years old, going on 18 in September 42. So I did that. But after going to classes and every day, I'd see another seat get empty. One here, the next day another place. And it didn't take long to understand these are the boys who are getting drafted or enlisting. And I was listening to the president. I lost my two friends that I mentioned. I had others who were going into the service. My friend Marty Friedman went into the service. He joined to become a paratrooper. Erko joined the Navy. And I thought, well, it became time for me to go. And I'm just soft-hearted at this age in life because you're bringing me in the memories. And I one day went to the at Ohio State. What's the department they had the military where you go in to enlist or become part of it? It's part of the ROTC program. I went in and I was already signed up for the reserves, but then I applied for active duty. And the day I'll never forget the rest of my life is when I came home and told my mother and father that I was going into the reserves. I was going into active duty. And you think that the weight of God was all over me. I was shrinking. Boy, my mother was screaming, "You tell me you're going to get killed." And I said, "Mom, I have to go." About a week and a half later, they took me in my dad's car up to Ohio State University, the Armory. And that's where I went on active duty. That's where I started my military training. So I went I was in service about 3 years. And for the first year, I went through basic training, which was about 3 months, 13 weeks. And then one day at the end of the training period, I was wondering, where am I going to go next? I was in the artillery because I chose the artillery, ROTC, and they put me into the artillery in training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And when I finished my basic training one day, they told me to get all dressed up in my khaki uniform and report to a certain place. And a few of us were taken in there. You know, you look nice. I went before a colonel, and you all went through individual interviews, and I had no idea what to expect. No idea. I says, what are they going to do with me? Going to send me into combat? Whatever they decide, I enlisted. I'm already military. I wasn't going to quit. In fact, I was saying, when I go in later, I says, what I think I'd like to do? Instead of going into the Army infantry or whatever, I think I'd like to eventually go into become a pilot. Just blonde hair. There's my picture right there. Take that out if you wish. Take a look at it. That was me in 1942, 43. So I went before the colonel, and one of the things he asked me is, soldier, he says, why do you want to become an officer? This is something I remember that day. 18 years old. Why do I want to become an officer? But I do remember my answer because God sent me the answer. He says, well, I think with enough training, I think I've got the ability to learn to become a leader of men. And I says, I knew at that time, I found out, because I was in the ROTC program, that turned out to be an automatic application into OCS, Officer Candidate School. And I really went behind the ears. Can I ask you how old you are now?
31.
31, so you... Far past the 18 years old.
That's true.
So I said, I think with training I can become. And he says, soldier, he says, we're going to need bridges. We're going to go into Germany. Because that's basically where the infantry. For the Japanese, those were probably a different group of GIs that went into that. But in my group, we felt that we were going to go into the European theater of operation. So he said, we're going to need bridges, and your record shows you were ROTC, so you're college material. We'd like to send you back to school to become an officer and help build bridges and whatever has to be done. I said, to myself, sounds like a good idea. I says, I'll go for that. He said, but have you heard of the ASTP program? Army Specialized Training Program. That became the new word, four letters, became the new part of the operation of the day, ASTP. And that's to send kids for further education for military purposes. So they chose, and I said, that sounds like that'll help me. If I can help the Army in any way, I'll do that. So they were opening up the colleges again. I mean, beside the people who were not taken into service, that all the girls that were in colleges, they had taken over a lot of parts of different universities. And the one that they chose to send me to was Syracuse.
Oh, I'm from Syracuse.
Really?
Yeah.
Onondaga Hotel?
Yeah.
Still there?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know, but that was it for the bunch of 80-year-olds. That's where we congregated for the 3 months I was there, 90 days. But I went to Syracuse University. They put us up in a barracks in a fraternity. Well, it was a dormitory, really.
Up on the hill there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dormitory.
Yeah.
I did. I was in the dormitory of Syracuse. And they started me into engineering. I went through mathematics, chemistry, physics, and all that. A whole bunch of us, probably several hundred and at that time, you know, the demand in the rosters in the school programs were going down because a lot of them were going into the service. But here I was in a military uniform. I had my ODs, and I went to classes, and I took chemistry, physics, all that stuff. I'm still 18 years old because I went in December, the first of the year, in December 42, and it got into be deferred 43. And one day we got a notice that a bunch of us are being transferred. Where are we being transferred? I wound up at University of Illinois. That's the Army for you. You don't know what they're doing. Nobody tells you anything. But they transferred me, took my duffel bag. I didn't have a suitcase, I had a duffel bag. My uniforms and all that. And they shipped a group of us by railroad, by the train, over to Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. And I went to University of Illinois. And I went there for the balance of 1943. And I went there for two quarters, one quarter Syracuse, two quarters. And toward the end of that year, we got the word, they're closing out the ASTP program. They got enough kids in the ASTP group, and we don't need as many engineers as we anticipated we would. So I got my walking papers. As a young kid, you'd say, where am I gonna go? I made application. I decided, you know, that's a love for this. I want to become a pilot. Something that's exactly what I wanted to do. I want to become a pilot. So a bunch of us took be able to get in there to take a physical. This is at the University of Illinois. I passed the physical. My eyes were good, 20/20 vision. I thought, well, I might as well become a flyboy. That's the thing of the day for me. I said, artillery, I don't want to be sitting by time all the way shooting these big cannon. I got some pictures to show you later, but I can shoot the cannon. But I like to become a pilot. It's part of my life because I never knew what I wanted to do. when you got the war on and you got guys losing their lives, and I says, well, I don't know where I'm going to wind up. But I says, at least I think I can become a pilot, and if I'm going to go down exciting. Mm-hmm. Well, a whole group of us, you know, this was a smart group, and I got a book, if you'd like to read it, I have it. It tells you all about the ASDP program, and it is what happened to them. And America, they were taking in so many people to different schools, they had so many ASDPers, that when they decided they had so many, a lot of them shipped overseas. And the 43s and 44s, the guys were just sent over as individuals, joining units to replace those who were shot. Mm. Me, when they closed down the program at University of Illinois, they sent me to Camp Gruber, Oklahoma, where I joined the 42nd Infantry Division, the Rainbow Division. And that's what I'm all about, the Rainbow Division. And that's where I spent the rest of my training in the Rainbow. And I wound up at Camp Gruber, Oklahoma, where they had the Rainbow was a MacArthur's division in 1917. He activated it, but it was a. You ever heard of the movie The Fighting 69th? That was a movie in the early movies, and this was an infantry regiment from New York. Mm-hmm. Fighting 69th, and the Rainbow was part of that in World War I. Anyway, in 42, they reactivated the Rainbow Division, which was MacArthur's old division. He started it in World War I. He started a division, but they reactivated in 42, and that's where I wound up. And they put me into the... because I had my, I went to the division, 42nd Division, with a bunch of other GIs, and we all went into the infantry, mm-hmm. and I took real basic training in infantry. I did the village fighting. I was shown how to fire machine guns. I was shown everything. We were in training for months. This is all 43. And I was taught everything there is to know about to be a doughboy. In fact, you go through one exercise, they put you in a hole about 4 feet wide and about 8 feet length, and they shoot machine guns over your head. Now, if you stick your head out, you're going to get your head blown off. Now, we're all smart enough to know your head stays down when you hear that machine gun. But you got to get used to the enemy fire. Mm-hmm. Got to get used to all that. Well, that's one. And I fired. I was taught how to use a machine gun. I was taught how to fire. I used an A1, an M1 rifle. I learned to do all that. And I think, well, whatever I got to learn to do it well so I live. If you don't learn, you're not going to live. You heard a story about the guys that stick their head. They jump up into somebody clips them. Well, when you're in a foxhole, you stay down till you know it's clear. Well, we went through a lot of foxhole training in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, in Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. Forgive me if I jump around, but Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. And sometime at the end of 44, one day they called me into the field office at the where I was going through the infantry training. And they told me they're assigning me, because I was in the ROTC, they're assigning me over to the artillery. And incidentally, that's where I had my basic training, because I was ROTC at Ohio State Artillery. So I knew all about the artillery, and they needed replacements. Before we went overseas, they needed replacements in the artillery. So, pack up your bag again, and you move to another camp, a part of the camp or something. And I was in the 42nd Infantry, but assigned to the artillery. And then I was assigned to the, then I, by God, after all these years, it's like the second thing in my head I know. I was Battery B, 542nd Field Artillery Battalion. Never forget that. That would go with me. I'll show you the take in my office and show you my discharge paper. It's all on the wall there. 542nd Field Artillery, Battery B. And they assigned me. Now, the guys that were with me, a lot of them were for Air Force guys who were also taken in to become officers. But those Air Force, boy, you're in there for a few months. They give you a corporal, they give you a sergeant, you know, all that. So there's a lot of fellows with me my age that already had stripes on their arms. And I was still a army with an enlisted man, no position, no non-commissioned person. So naturally, the Air Force boys, just being in the Air Force, they got corporals, sergeants. But I'll tell you, in the military, in the Army, you got to be pretty good at your position to become a leader of men. Artillery, in the Air Force, if you're just a mechanic there, they give you a non-commissioned rating. So a lot of guys went ahead of me. Mm-hmm. But when I went over the artillery, even they brought a lot of these Air Force boys over there with their non-commissioned insignias. They transferred them into the artillery. But they had the rank over me because that's the way. Nothing's perfect. The Army wasn't perfect. So they had a lot of corporals in there.
But they were the same age.
They were same age, same back schools, all this. But they were corporals. And they couldn't give me a corporal when they got enough corporals in the structure of the military. So I stayed. Finally, I made PFC, private, you know, where you get one stripe. But the two stripes and the three stripes, the sergeants. But in the infantry, in the military, Army, you got to get somebody killed or something or have a 20 years of service before you get those sergeant stripes. So we trained, and I became a Jeep driver when I signed to the 542nd Field Artillery Battalion. And I'm going to give you all this stuff that you can, you'll have it on there. I was in the 542nd Field Artillery Battalion, and I was a Jeep driver assigned to the 42nd Battery B. And my job in training was learned because they signed me to the field artillery since I was transferred over to the artillery. Mm-hmm. And the artillery is 155s and the 105s and the 155s. The 105s...
These are howitzers.
Is the 105s was comparable to the German, but I can't even think of theirs. They had the small, you know, those are fast moving. You can pick up those 105s by the tail and move around and pull them around. The 155s were new, large guns. And I'll show you pictures later. I mean, I got something about the 155s. But these were the shells were about that long. Mm-hmm. They could travel about 15 miles in the air. And when you exploded, you pulled the lanyard on a howitzer. When that thing went out, it goes 7-8 miles. Those were powerful. Those were the new weapons in World War II. The old ones, which would carry over in World War I, was the 105s, which were small. The shells were about that long, but the 155s were that long. They could take out a whole unit. But I was assigned because of the Jeep. They assigned me to be the leader in manipulating the group wherever we went. I was always the lead Jeep. In fact, when we landed in Europe, I was a Jeep driver for the 42nd Infantry Division, Battery B. And I took my captain all over the place. I was all over the place driving my Jeep. And we landed in Europe in 1944, in October of 44, just at the time of the Battle of the Bulge. And we went into combat there. And we just went into position. We came from Marseille. We landed at Marseille. not from Le Havre. We came not from the north. We came from the south. There was a big highway that took us right into the combat area where they wanted us to type. And that's where the Battle of the Bulge was. Mm-hmm. We went right into that 42nd Infantry Division, went right into the Battle of the Bulge. And let me tell you, it was hell. It was January, February in Europe. That was cold. I mean, where are you from?
New York, upstate New York.
Well, so you know what cold weather is. I'm from Dayton, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio, and you get a lot of snow and you get the zero weather. My daughter's in Chicago. You get the zero weather, so I know all about it. And that's probably why I'm out in Florida now, because I'm in the 80s now. So I'm just not going to go into the cold weather now. But anyway, so I was the Jeep driver, and I was sent all over. The captain had me running all over the place. I was to take him. I was the Jeep. And I was also taught to how to issue shipping firing commands, because I was assigned to a lieutenant of our company, Battery B, 42nd Infantry Division. I was assigned to the to watch where our shells were going, so we could, because we used to go into on the highest pick area we could find and look to see where our shells were going, and then we'd get the word where to fire, to contact our command again, because we had the big guns, and they just, we had, I don't even remember the commands, but you'd fire one half a degree or whatever it is. We had to tell them where to turn their shell, where to put their sight, so they could shoot the next shell. And we could see by being on a hill, the observer, which is our lieutenant, who was executive, and the observer and me, where that thing landed. So we know, go up 1 degree or 2 degrees to the left, to the right, whatever it was. And one time we had him on the run, and I got all excited because our shells were landing. I could see them 7 miles away. I could see his shells landing. And I said, "Shelly, we got him. We got him." He said, "Soldier, you'll call me lieutenant till this war's over." I'll never forget this looker. He was chicken shit. He said, "You'll call me lieutenant till this war's over." I said, "Boy, that's something." He said, I got so excited because we were doing a good job. And he had to tell me, "I'm going to call him lieutenant till the war's over." You know what he did for a living? He was a little older than me, because I was, 19 or 20. He was about 24, 25. He was an usher at the theater at night. Who knows what else he was doing? But he got enough to get a commission, go to OCS. And he got to be a commissioned officer. I never know. He was from he was from Chicago. But I never could find him in the phone book, because I had a daughter moved to Chicago there, and I could never find Lieutenant Schilling. Well, there was Jack Schilling, so anyway. I'll even show you his picture when this is over. So, I was landed in Marseille with the about a group of ships, and it was cold, it was freezing, and we had to set up tents outside of Marseille, and all I know is we're going into combat. And it was toward the end of the bulge, so that's where we went into. And it was freezing. And a couple of weeks later, the bulge time ended and the break started. And then we got the word that we were going to head in through the bulge and head into Germany. Now, we crossed in 1940, early 45, we crossed the Rhine River. The one I was going to build bridges? Mm-hmm. Bridges were there already. The other guys had built the bridges. They had these gas tanks, that you put gas in. They put them, lined them up out there, and they put boards across them. That's how they made bridges.
Just floated on there.
Floated on there, and they tied them together. That's the way. That was the another team of military did that. They made those bridges, made those little bridges, so you could take troops across. And we took our artillery pieces across those things to get in where we were going, because we crossed the Rhine River, and we were heading. Now, when we're done, I'll show you pictures, because if I do it now, I'll lose my train of thought. So we crossed the Rhine River, and then we went into the combat. That's where the Germans were. they were, we went up through, we were in France, and we went, and I got a map here I'm going to show you. Mm-hmm. That's where we went through France, where we went, and we went into Germany. And I like, you know, war is always hell, but it's when you're scared, when you cross on some road and you don't have any idea who's in those forests over there, you certainly wonder who's hiding in that forest. Somebody take a pot shot. And we were always told, have a bullet in your chamber. I'll tell you, would you rather me tell you a story about one incident later or now?
Now, let's do it. Now?
Yeah. I'll tell you a story. One night in Germany, since I'm the Jeep driver and I had the command of the car, we captured a Nazi officer. An arrogant SOB. Arrogant as hell. We're right in the heart of Germany. Oh, well, I should have. I yell at my wife. She didn't get me. I got all, everything around it that you can see. But we captured it. Somebody captured him around the outskirts of the artillery and brought him into some command post that we had. The captain was there and the lieutenant was there and all that. And we were probably by candlelight. And we were questioning this. And he was an arrogant SOB. He was, you could tell by his marks, he was a German officer. Arrogant as hell, just the way they picture him in the movies. And he would say nothing. He would say absolutely nothing. We couldn't get a word out of him what he's supposed to say. Finally, our captain says, "Hey, Melman, you get take the first sergeant and you take him into battalion headquarters and you tell him they can take care of this son of a bitch. And you tell him because we can only go so far with him and they'll know how to get it out of him where all the troops are and all that." So do you know that on a Jeep, there's a iron piece that's built off the bumper, goes up in the air, and there's a little cut in it that if you come across in the highway, if you hit a wire, it won't cut your head off, because Jeeps have always had their windshields down. Mm-hmm. So we had that little wire that goes on the bumper, and it would cut.
The wire going across.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So this sergeant, this officer, he sat in front, and I had the first sergeant with me. He was a man, I guess, in the early 40s and all that. Boy, he was loaded with beer. You could just tell by his stomach, the kind you'd see in the movies. But he was, so when we're driving along, I'm driving in a blackout in the middle of Germany, and he said to me, "Let's kill the son of a bitch." He said, "Let's kill him. Let's kill him." I said, "Sergeant, nobody's killing anybody. We're going to take him in. I got the assignment to take him there, and he's going to get there, get to the headquarters. And I'm driving in a blackout anyway, because you don't drive with the lights on, because the air force, there's people all around, and you don't know who's in those forests, a lot of the German soldiers and all that." So we came to moonlight night, and we came to a turn in the road where you go to the left, and we came and I thought I better stop and get my bearing again. So one thing that you're always told, if you're out somewhere, have that bullet in the chamber. Now I'm the driver, and the first sergeant, who's probably 20 years in the service, you think you'd know from a hole in the ground. You know, which one? You ever heard that joke when you were a kid? Can you tell which is your ass or which is a hole in the ground? So we go, and the guy, he's holding on. He takes a look around, and he slides off. And I think to myself, God, I got my carbine. I got a racket back. I didn't have one in there. I should have, but the sergeant couldn't even find that what the handle was with the rifle he has. He couldn't find anything. And by that time, the guy slid off, and he took a look at us, and he takes off to the woods. Well, that was one night I'll never forget in my life, because I don't know who in the hell's in there. And he gets away, and so I turn the Jeep around, I flash the lights right into those woods, and he's gone. And I don't care who's with me. The guy may be God, he's not Goddard, but he's a sergeant. But he's not telling me. I says, "We're going back. I'm not going in there." So I took him back, and I reported that the lieutenant is missing in action. And I said, the sergeant should have had him on his line of fire. When he slid off, he should have had him on there and say, don't move or I'll pull this trigger. I'll never forget that. Never forget that. Well, I don't know. He disappeared. But we went back, and I'm traveling without lights on. I'm traveling in the darkness. But we went back. I flipped the lights off and on because I'm getting the hell out of there. I don't know where I'm going.
How do you travel without the lights on?
By the moon? Mm-hmm. When you're traveling in a blackout, you don't have anything on. Because they can take a pot shot. You turn the lights on, they see the two lights, they know there's somebody driving the car, just pull the trigger in there, you're going to get somebody. But there's only one way you're going to travel at night. You know, you got to have some kind of vision. Now, some nights are more lighted than others. But this was a dark night because I kept looking. And I said, that's the road going right here. And I see, you could just see some trees over there. And I don't know what we're at, but I knew the direction because I studied the map before we left. And I had a feeling we were going to make a left turn in the road. And it said that turn that he got away. So that was an experience. So we went back without the guy. But so we went through the war, and we did a lot of shooting. So we evidently, the 42nd Rainbow Division got a lot of, when the war was over, and we got the Rainbow Bulletin, which I used to get there. It used to tell us what some of the awards that were given for the 42nd Division for their artillery. You know, it was personal things for us. We did pretty well in our shooting. I'll finish this. Let me continue with the story and I'll show it to you. So, you can put in what you want. When we finally starts heading south, we went through the north part of Germany. Where are all my maps? I got all kinds of maps here. I've done this for a couple of years already, you see, so. Well, anyway, we were heading south, and we got to the big road in Germany from, where's a map? That's it. There's a section of road that was built by Hitler.
The Autobahn.
The Autobahn, thank you. Yeah. The Autobahn, the famous Autobahn. I was on the Autobahn, and we got on the Autobahn, and we're heading south. We're heading south, and we're going down the Autobahn, down Germany, and our destination with the 42nd Infantry Division, because we went through all the battles and all, is to go into liberate Munich. And this was already in May 1945, March, February, April, and May. We were heading down the Autobahn to get into Munich and liberate Munich, because that's the last major city. Here's a picture that happens to pop up in front of me, so I'll let you look at it. This is a picture of the Rainbow from where we landed in Marseille, and we went around through here, and we're heading south. And if you'll look, you'll see the word that we're coming to. You'll see that's where we're coming. And we're coming south, and we're going into Munich. And on the way, on the Autobahn, the radio message comes over to our captain. He's the captain of the battery B-42nd Infantry Division, battalion. He says, you're going to come into a spot and you're to continue on that spot until we tell you otherwise. So they gave me the directions. They knew right where I'm at on their map, where I'm at. And they said, as soon as you get to a certain place, you will turn right. But be prepared. Now, be prepared means only one thing in the military. Good thing.
Okay, we're good.
Take whatever you want.
See, no, I'm just checking the recorder to make sure.
Is it working?
Yep, it's working fine. Yep.
He said, and be prepared means that you've always got a bullet in your chamber. I don't know how brave you are. You don't know what the hell you are in Germany. It's a nice country. And this is right smack on the, you got the map there, mm-hmm. Germany? It's and we're heading south. You see Munich on the map? Mm-hmm. Well, that's where we were heading. So, how did they go? And as we start approaching Munich, and boy, that's a two lanes this way, two lanes the other way. That's first, and we just have some of the national, like Interstate 70 interstates. A few of those were just started in this country. This is back in 1944 or 45. And we were going that, and so we were heading down, and we were told to get off this road, and we're going into a special assignment. They don't tell you anything on the radio because the Germans had access to our radios, so they don't know, and they don't know who they're talking to, they don't know who we are, where we are, but we had our codes to be listened to. So we're heading to the right, and then we're heading south again. Suddenly we come to a sign in the road that says DACHAU. It's another town. Didn't mean anything to me. A lot of towns. And you pass by the little town of Dachau, and you see little homes in there. It's a small community.
Had you heard anything about other concentration camps?
Nothing.
And no one had talked about it at home? No one knew?
Well, when I left, nobody knew. I'd heard the word concentration camps, but that doesn't mean anything to me unless you see one. I wasn't thinking. I'm thinking not get killed. My thing is on my mind is not to be killed and shot, because we're out to destroy the German army, not to look for a camp. Never even thought about it, about a camp. It's to help me. I wasn't just thinking. I was thinking of, because the Germans, we're in their country, right in there. So we're told to continue, and we pass the town that says Dachau. My rider gets on the radio again. And says, oh, there's Dachau. Does that mean anything? He says, you just keep on going. You're on the right track. You'll see an armed resistance up a road. Be aware. Scared as hell, but that's life in there. Finally, we come across, we're going down the Autobahn Highway, and we see in a distance a bunch of wired fences. It's probably, I'd say about, well, I don't think I could see 10th Street from here. That's a street up there. Mm-hmm. Be farther, I'd say about 200 feet up. You could see some wired, barbed wire fences and something on there, and you see wire fences going about high into the air. I says, oh boy, we're coming into something. And sure enough, we were coming into this area, and it was called Dachau. That's what the name was, and that's a Dachau. Soon as the word got to us that this has to be a concentration Dachau, I said, we had heard about it. Dachau concentration camp. And we pulled into that place, and I had 60 vehicles behind me. I'm the leader. I mean, a little 18-year-old, 19-year-old Bernie Melman is the leader. But I had the lieutenant who's in his late 20s, early 30s. Lieutenant, he was there, and we knew that we hit upon something, and boy, be prepared.
Were there allies already in no. the camp? You were the first person to yes. enter the camp.
Well, at that time, when I saw him, I was. And as you come closer, following this thing up to the coming on, we come by this barbed wire fence, and we can look through the fence, and we're coming down the road, and I'll show you a picture in a minute. And as we turn right, we could see there's an entrance. But just at that entrance, we see about 120, 130 dead German soldiers in their uniform laying flat on the ground, dead. It happens. What's your first name?
Steve.
Steve. Don't mind me. I'm thinking of I'm in the memory, so I'll forget Steve. That's a good name. But Steve, I'm trying to get to tell you how, because when I saw that, when we came up to the, we could see where the gate was to go inside there. Suddenly we see right in front of that gate, the fence site on the green grass right in front of it, there's about 150 dead German soldiers all laying there sprawled out. And I'm going to show you pictures. I got them in here, but I don't want to stop it right now. I want to show you the pictures. And those were the German guards who were cut down by the group that was ahead of us by an hour. Now, this is about 10 o'clock in the morning, so this had to be about 9 o'clock. And that's the doughboys. The infantry got there. And the infantry travels with their trucks, and they're loaded to the bear. And they came in there, and what they did is they shot all the guards out of their towers. There's probably about 8-9 towers in there. And when I came in there, I saw the guards were already dead. They were shot. They were brought over to that, and right by the entrance into the Dachau concentration camp. Well, you know, when you got a 19-year-old kid, you know, you're still shaking up, but this is war, and I know we just got to find out what's going on.
Was that the first time you saw people on the battlefield dead?
Yeah, you saw 150 German dead right there, just like all over the place. What there was, and I got a picture here, just don't let me forget, I'll show it to you, but I don't want to, if I cut, then I'll forget where I'm at. But I'll show you the picture. I got a picture of the dead soldiers in front, just in front of that fence. And I'll tell you, were you just so glad to see him dead? Never. I don't like, well, the whole day is I've lived for all these years, but we decided to go into the entrance. We knew the doughboys were here. When we saw the dead soldiers, we knew the doughboys were here. Because 42nd Infantry Division, the Rainbow, was the first one there. The Battery B of our division was the first one at this particular site. Doughboys got in because they came to the gate site. They got in. They had to find out where the because all those fence were above high in the air. They were all electrified. So somebody had to get there first and be able to turn them off. Because this is around 10 o'clock in the morning. So somebody had to get there to turn those fences, those gate sites off, and they shot all those guards. And the guards wound up on the below, and I guess they hauled them out. So at that time, the bodies were still fresh, still warm when we got there. Those 140. I got pictures to show you, so. So at least we knew that our doughboys were there, and they were in that there, and we're at the camp, and the camp's under control. So we did walk in, and the 42nd Infantry boys, that's Company A's, Company B's, Company C's, they were all over, and they were all put into position first thing. The general, whoever our general was at the time, he knew what to expect, and he had already the American officers aware of what's to be done. So we were in there, and we were assigned to go and to guard against the fence. But before that, he says, fellas, before you can go to be guard on the fence site, we're giving you half an hour to walk through here to figure out what you're seeing. So we saw that we're at a concentration camp. It's called Dachau. And a lot of the inmates, as we were there, we didn't have loudspeakers. We had bullhorns. The bullhorn sounded that all the inmates are to go back to their barracks. And they were a emaciated bunch of people. They were 75, 80, 90 pounds, 100 pounds. But they were emaciated, but they're just happy. We're free. And I'll tell you more about that later, because I'll tell you, that night we were on good guard duty at the thing, and those guys are so happy. They just want to touch us. They just want to touch our finger. We're free. We're free. We're free at the gate site. And it's sprechen nicht Deutsch. I don't speak German. And they parlay a French from my high school. But when we were in that camp, just standing around, we were told that we would be 42nd Infantry Division artillery. Spend a half an hour going through the site, see it, because you got to get on guard duty. And guard duty means on a section, because they didn't want any of the inmates. The inmates, they didn't want them to escape. Those were all sick human beings. They were all fed up with all kinds of dysentery. They had nothing in their system. They were all weighing 75, 80 pounds, barely moving. So they didn't want them to escape into the public, and it'd be terrible to have all those inmates all over Europe and Germany and all that. It's a nice little area back there. It's a small town in Germany, but the government, our federal government, was prepared. They knew what it was. So I'm not the first one to know, but they were, which is important. You know, when they sent those bombers out, they know we're headed, and they know what's to come back. So they knew. They knew that. They, in fact, when the infantry boys got there, somehow they were told where you turn off the electricity into those barbed wires, because those barbed wires were all activated to touch them. If you touch them, you get electrocuted. They didn't want the prisoners to get out and provide all this. The Germans didn't. They didn't want the sick people to get out and pass it all to the public. So they had all those, the fences went up, and then they go up like this back into the, and those were all electrified fences. So anyway, we got to go, and I got some pictures here I'll be happy to share with you, show you some of the pictures that we saw in the camp that I got from, so there's been several books written on Dachau. There's about 80 other concentration camps, but that was one of the major ones. And so finally, they you heard a bullhorn say, okay, 42nd Infantry Division, Battery A, Battery B, Battery C, Battery D, back into to go on your guard assignment. And they had told us before where our guard assignment was. So we had a certain part of the fence, the 300, 400 of us were to protect that fence. Miles around the place, but we all had sections because they didn't want the prisoners to escape. They didn't want the prisoners to pass all the everything they had into the society. They wanted to hold them in there. And it's your...
Just start this up again.
Oh. Okay. You okay now?
Yep.
So anyway, we walked through, we saw the crematorium, we saw where they kept the dogs, we saw the dead people in there. I mean, that's a sight. And you can get stick in your stomach. But 60 years later, I'm used to it. I saw all the sites, which I have some sites here to show you. I saw the crematoriums. And I can only tell you one thing, it really happened. And God is my witness. There were a few dead bodies outside. We were told, please stay away from the barracks, because the inmates were dying in there. They go around every morning. The other inmates who were well went around, and they'd stack them. They'd stack them on the Well, they were stacked all over the place. But the Americans were there. Americans were there. So finally, we went on guard duty. We went out of the... naturally, I was the leader. You know, men followed me. Followed me. We went back to our Jeep, which is on a highway right outside the barracks there. And we went to... We knew what our assignment... We were instructed where our assignment is to be there for the next several hours. We didn't know what to expect. You know, still in a state of shock, but we got to see the camp.
Did you talk about it?
Oh, God. So all we did was talk about, my God, is this real? When you see emaciated people, 80, 90 pounds, but we knew this is a concentration camp. This is where they were in. And we knew that's a crematorium. While we were in there, and when I go through the pictures, I'll show you the crematorium. Those are the people that were in there. The crematorium was loaded with a room, probably from here to here to here, all loaded with bodies. If you could get 800 or 1,000 bodies in there, they were crisscrossed across each other. They were dead. They were dead. They were brought in from other campsites to be cremated in Dachau. They were there. And a lot of them were just died who were in the barracks. A lot of the thousands of inmates were working at the barracks. There were factories at Dachau to build bearings and things like that. That's what they did at Dachau. It was a work camp, but it was also a death camp. So when we knew our assignment was to keep the thousands and thousands, there's probably about 30,000 people in that camp. And our job was to keep them in there, not to let them, so we could start processing them. So we found our assignment at the fence site. And we were there, and we stayed there, and we spent that evening there. A lot of the inmates that were over there, they were up and they were from there. Right in front of us were a lot of barracks where they lived. And a lot of them came over and they kept putting their hand in. And they kept, just wanted to touch Americans, just wanted to touch us. And I didn't speak German, and I still don't speak German. But I have a version of Yiddish, which is similar to... of the Jewish, which is a takeoff from German. And it seemed like I got to be the spokesman in the little section of the gate that I was at to listen to about 10 to 15 of them that came over and they put their hands through the fence. And they just want you to touch your hand. They just want to touch your hands. Maroon's free. Maroon's free. We are free. We're free. I could cry. They could cry. But you know, as I even look back on it, they were like just so happy. They're free. And the thing is, the barrier was I don't speak. And some were from Poland. Some were from, a lot of them were there from Germany. But the Germans talked to them in German. So they got used to the Germans. All they lived, the ones that were still living, they learned how to take the orders because they when the German's a tough language. Achtung. You know, they were tough. So the sites that I see, I'm going to lead you to it, to show it to you. But the... that evening, I spent about 2-3 hours. It was dark, but there were some lights that they permitted on so they could light up the camp a little bit and to just show some. But the Americans came in. The general, I can't think of his name. He brought the food in for them. Boy, I'll tell you, those trucks just kept piling in all night and the next morning. And they all had the Red Cross on them, white Red Cross, just to bring them food to eat. Because we were told not to feed them. Says you can give them a cigarette if they wanted. But they were just, but not to feed them, not to give them any food.
Would the food shock their system?
Yeah, the food would shock their system. So they, but the military knew what to feed them. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever they gave them, I don't even remember what they fed them. I don't know. You know, we had in our convoy with the 42nd Infantry Division, Battery B, we had our kitchen in a truck. And they made lunch for us, and they passed it on. You know, whatever they made, we could eat that night a little bit. And the next morning, when we just took out our bags that we slept in, and it was already January 29th, 30th, 31st, we slept on the ground, you know, in our bags. Next morning we got up and we were told to get dressed, do whatever we had to, relieve yourself, and went over to the where the mess sergeant had set up a kitchen for the 42nd rate for Battery B, 542nd. There was thousands of GIs piling into that place, starting it from all directions. You could just see the cars, the military. Red Cross trucks piling up. You could see the Army with their two and a half GM trucks pulling all over the place, because that's how they move the infantry, move them all around. Everybody had all kinds of vehicles, thousands of vehicles.
Were they there to assist with what was going on?
Oh, yeah, first thing, the generals wanted every American soldier that was there to see it. They were smart enough, but as soon as I get the books out, I remember my general. He was all prepared. He had the cooks of the Battery B and the Battery A, Battery B, Battery C, Battery D. He had them all in the kitchens working to make food. And able to start feeding the people with the type of nourishment that he expect them to have. You don't give them anything, they'll have trouble digesting. And we were told not to feed them. Not to feed them. He says, don't give them anything, it'll make them sick. So don't be a judge of what's to feed them. But the federal government had the boys in there to start manning the kitchens for the Germans. The Germans disappeared. What happened the night before we got there? They all knew that the Germans, the soldiers, they knew the miracles will happen, so a lot of them just took off. They got the hell out of there. They just blended into the society. They just changed clothes, got out of their uniforms, and they just mixed into the public, which I didn't give a damn. What did I care? I mean, that's not the problem I have. We still got the Germans to defeat. We were on our way to Munich, and I knew that always, because we always lose a few men wherever you go. So I was pretty tough. But some of those sites, which I'd like to have you see, some of those, if you can add, you want to add to that, you can tell what you're, but basically this was it. And the next morning, we went back, and we went down back to the way we came in. We went back to the Autobahn, and the Autobahn back to where we finally came into Munich. And while we were approaching Munich...
I have one question before we get to Munich. Sure. Did they take local Germans from the town of Dachau through the camp to show them while you were there?
No.
No.
But this is what happened. As soon as we left, I was still in combat. So our job was to go to Munich. The war was still on, and we didn't know what to expect in Munich. But the story was, is that the Americans, all the people who were trained for that, stayed in there, and they got all the people from Dachau City to come in, and they gave each person, when I show you what was in the crematorium, they made all those people got a decent burial, and the burials were created by the people of Dachau, the residents. They had to dig all their, I think I got pictures of those. the dot com. And I got a book here, so boy, this everything's going bad on me. I got a book here that I'm willing to loan it to you if you give me the honest report that you'll give it back, because this is the book on Dachau. Hermann Göring, The War Against the Jews. Let's see, the name of this book, The Holocaust Chronicle, The History and Pictures. My whole experience. This is a new book. I hadn't even been in here yet. Bev saw it someplace, and she bought it for me. You'll find better pictures than I have, because it shows you all the. But what they did. But what they did is to. Got pictures here. You can hold it. See.
Thanks.
That's a picture of my experiences. I mean,
So what happened when you got to Munich?
So when we got to Munich, I gotta think for a minute. When we got to Munich, there were hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands, of German soldiers lined up on each, as we approached, on the Autobahn, approaching the city. They were all heading in to turn in their guns, to turn in all their weapons, and I'm sure there were, since we had all kinds of brass, military brass, they knew exactly what to do. They took them all and they put them into their wherever they kept the prisoners. And we went on to Munich. We saw no resistance in Munich. And we went into an area that we just decided, say, this is where you stop. And this is where we were told to stop. And we stayed there for about 2-3 days. And we were to man, most of us got to man parts of the streets. Keep the people from being organized. No concentration of people. The thing I remember most is all the women and the little with their babushkas coming up to me, Munich's Nazi, Munich's Nazi. I said, and as best as I could explain to them, did you know what's 30 miles away? Do you know that camp there? No camp. I said, you got people being burned. So we tried to explain it to them. No. My brother in Chicago. Everybody's got relatives in New York. You know, that's what they're telling you. That's their line. You don't afraid we'll shoot them. But that's, and then we spent about 4 or 5 days there. We went out toward the end of it, and they got the beer joints open so the Americans could get some beer. And everybody was friends. Southern Germans were friends. The Americans are here, you know, like nothing happened. But so they didn't know what to do with us. I wound up in Austria, which is south of Germany, Austria. The whole division wound up in Austria. And I was in Austria probably wondering, put our tents up and we stayed there, and the cooks had brought a lot of food in and we could eat there. We just wondered, and one day I was there probably about 2 weeks wondering, because nobody knew what to do. You know, you're a trained soldier. What are you? You're not supposed to do anything. So we went into town. I got a little leather brace that I fit in here, that I had a pistol. I captured a German pistol and I can keep it here. I got that put away, German pistol. It's a Walther 32. But I had that made in Austria. And then one it happened that one day they called me out wherever we were staying. Probably staying in tents. My name was called out and told to go to battalion headquarters, and went to battalion headquarters. And they read off a bunch of names, and my name was one of them. He says, "You're leaving us. Where are you going?" "You'll find out soon enough. We don't tell you where you're going, but you're leaving us. You're being assigned." So the next morning, after I was at the battalion headquarters, company headquarters, and then battalion headquarters. A truck came by and picked a few of us up. They're called by name, Melman, whoever his name was on there. And it went around the whole area picking up the GIs who were assigned to someplace. I says, "Where am I going now?" So they took us to a town nearby in Austria. And probably accumulated about 400 or 500 people there, GIs. Nobody knows what's going on. But this was already in July of 1945. Mm-hmm. And, we're all good friends, and everybody's glad to see each other, you know. We're all standing around. What the hell are they sending us? What's going on? And nobody knows. Nobody knows. All of a sudden, you hear a couple of toots from a train. And the train is backing up on a siding. Oh, so everybody's running to the siding. Boy, I'll tell you, you see hundreds of people all running to the siding. And the train backs up, and the last car, now what do you call the last car on a train?
Caboose. A caboose?
Yeah, I guess he could call it that, because the colonel get up there, and he got a bullhorn. And he stands there, and we're all wondering, what the hell? I says, "Where are you going?" I says, "The war's over here. What are you going to do with us? Can't train us anymore. We're all combat veterans." But the colonel gets up, you can tell by his eagles here. He says, "Men, you don't hear a sound. Don't hear a sound." And that's Hollywood for you. Holly said, "You're to see this train come in. Well, before you start your way back to..." "Before you start your way back to God's country..." Did we pick loose? We're going home. We've been assigned to go home. Don't know why, but we're going home. Later we found out why. We were chosen because whatever our MOS number, our number for the military was, we were assigned to go to Japan. So I'll be God. We were heading back to the country, United States of America, to join another division. And I got it written down, I don't think the 106th or something, because I got out my uniform. Let me show you my uniform. You're here, you got a minute. You're not...
I'm not going anywhere.
Let me find my uniform. Melman's uniform.
Yeah, that's my discharge.
Made corporal, finally. You see that? That's the important part of my whole story. That belongs on your left shoulder.
That's the rainbow.
That's a rainbow. That's a rainbow division. I made corporal. Rainbow, but this is where I was assigned to a new division where I went when I went the boat home. And I think I had to go on the television and look it up because the Army, my records got destroyed with thousands and thousands of others in St. Louis under a big farm fire for the U.S. Army.
I heard about this. When did it happen?
Oh, probably 25, 30 years ago, jeez. 40 years ago.
It's unbelievable.
Can you imagine all my records that I want? You see, I took combat, excuse my figure, but I took combat training in the 42nd Infantry Division. I became a trained soldier to be a infantryman. I did everything for the infantry. I mean, I went through village fighting. I went through everything I could. And they promised me a combat infantryman's badge. They transferred me over to the artillery because they needed somebody with sense, I guess, to help to be able who could run the battle, give the messages when you're loading artillery pieces. At least I had the brain power to do that because they took me calculus at Syracuse University. But this is my, you know, my loot for the two combat zones I was in and all that. But this is where they assigned me to this division.
So they were assigning you to a new division to
before,
go to
before
Japan.
I left Germany. Mm-hmm. Before I left Germany, this is a division I was assigned to. Mm-hmm. Now, I can go on the internet and pull up all these, you can get all that, and they'll tell me what division. But, you know, it'll go one head and not the other. But that's... But this still fits me. This is what I came home with in my army. Still? Yeah, this is my ODs. This is what I brought back from Germany. I had this when I came home.
So how did you get home?
We took these cattle cars. Oh, what I didn't finish up. I was still when the general. The colonel who was on the end of that railroad train said, "You're starting back to God's country," and we all were piled into different cars. I don't know who I didn't have any friends there. So we they counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, next one. You go to the next one. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I didn't go with any buddies. No, none of my, well, in fact, I had already left my buddies at the Battery B. I already left them the day before when they sent me to this place and trucks were taking us through. Oh, you got it on?
Yep.
Okay. So they I'm giving you the whole works.
This is good. You're okay?
Oh, yeah. I guess got to go back on my new computer, that's all. No, and Bev will be here, so I want her to meet you.
Yeah.
So she's okay, thank God.
So the general made a speech. You got
he told us we're going back to God's country, but we were on redeployment to the Pacific Theater of Operation. We had already been assigned. We learned later. Now I didn't have any money. We from January through, July, August, when we went back to Le Havre, France on the cattle car. Hadn't been paid. I don't have anybody. What I'd done with it anyway. But when we got on the boat, boy, you see, they gave us some pay. And boy, some of the guys came home broke. They had to gamble, you know, whatever they lost. I didn't play, so I figured I had a few dollars when I came home. But I knew that we were assigned to a division and be a combat because that's what I was trained. I was trained in my records. At that time, hadn't been burned up yet. That's a damnedest thing for me, that our records are destroyed by fire. Now, I called St. Louis one time. I talked to a lady. She said, you come down here. Says, you want to spend a few days here? And she says, we got some places you can look to see. Maybe you'll find something. But I'm not going to fly back to St. Louis and spend my days in a big building someplace, regardless what they have. So, but they did promise me the combat infantryman's badge because I went through all that training. I had all that training to be, to that. I mean it day in and day out and day in. It's just fortunate that I had my MOS number, which is a military number. I had that I was an artillery expert because I had the training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And I was ROTC at IC. I didn't learn anything. Probably to march, that's all I learned there. But I wasn't at the at Fort Sill. I became a good artilleryman.
So what happened when you got to France?
Now I'm going to show you pictures.
Okay.
Where are they? I hope I got them. Let me just. Let me throw you everything I got, just thinking about it. I don't think I got it. Oh, interview by Ben Houston. I hope I have that here someplace. That's a young fellow from the University of Florida.
Came down to interview. Huh? Ben Houston is his name.
You have access.
I could find his paper for sure.
He did a terrific job on me. Maybe this is it. This is my little treasure. This is second. I'm looking for me, so you don't have to. I'm in here, I'm just looking, and I can't even find me now. See if you can find me. This is 547 Field Artillery Battalion. Well, I want you to know you're talking to the real McCoys, he said.
Mr. Melman, can I ask you about what it was like going home for the first time?
When I came home?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got to tell you what the humor was. I'm looking for my picture. That's what I'm looking for. And the darn it, it's got to be here. How come I can't? Well, it's been a long time since I looked in here. This is 542nd Field Artillery Battalion. Service Battery, 542nd. Some of my friends from here are gone already. But you can look, but my picture's in it. I went to several conventions This is First Sergeant. Boy, he never had the mustache. Turned out to be gray. I think he passed away recently. Walter. Yeah. But I'm 542nd Field Artillery Battalion. I'm not the service battery. That was the guy who took care of the vehicles. Whatever they called him, he was the service. You see me here? Well, I'm just, that's why I'm looking. It was a young burning moment. Headquarters battery. No, I'm not headquarters battery. Battery B. No wonder you can't find me.
It's battery C. Here's battery B.
Battery B. Where's the best looking fellow in the place? Battery B.
That's not you, is it?
Nope. Battery C, battery B. Oh. Yeah, this is all the brass. Oh, that's 402nd. 402nd battery B. Oh, there's some more. Ah, darn. Okay, well.
That's not you? No. Jeez, I don't know.
That's funny. Boy, it's been a few years since I looked at this. You don't find it, my wife will find it. Oh, I'm not giving up. Okay. Let me see.
Hello.
Hi. Honey, this is...
Hi. That's okay, thank you. Don't get up.
Okay.
My eyes are dilated, so I'm not seeing too well.
Okay.
I drove all the way for the other side of town.
See how many times I've given this speech?
What all are you doing with this? I mean, what?
I can't find my picture in that battery B.
It's in there someplace. I find it, but I can't see. I'm sorry that I lost my cleaner if I remembered you were coming.
It's
meantime,
fine.
Right on the refrigerator is a card with your name, the time, but we had too many other things going today.
Boy, I'm
going
to have to replace you.
Start this up again.
Okay, you should have a hearing this story.
Okay.
I was on this ship coming home to wherever I was to meet with the new group to go on to Japan. This is in April 1945, and we were sent back on these cattle cars, and we got to the Le Havre, and finally the ships came in that were supposed to take us home, and that's when they gave us a few dollars to spend to buy whatever on a ship, whatever there was, and then we were going to go home, and then we were entitled to 45 we were entitled to a 30-day furlough when we got home and then report to Camp Atterbury, North Carolina, at Camp Atterbury, Indiana. And so I spent 30 days meeting with friends that were home and people that I haven't seen in 3 years. And when I back to camp, they didn't know what to do with me. The war had ended. I didn't have enough points. Because I hadn't been overseas. I've been overseas about 9 months. And some people are over 3-4 years and they hadn't gotten home yet. Mm. So I didn't have the points to get discharged. So I wrote a letter to Senator Taft of Ohio. He was a well-known Republican senator from Ohio. And I said, I really would like to go back to school. I want to get my education started again. I'm battle trained. I'm battle hardened. I says, I don't want to sit here and can't pick up cigarettes every day. Dear Mrs. Melman, that's how I got the reply. We're doing everything to see that the points are adjusted so your son can get out of the service. It's he and the secretary, and she probably typed up 100 letters like that every day. So they finally lowered the points, and I was able to get out. I got back and went to school. So I didn't know really what to do with myself.
Did you go to school on the GI Bill?
That's right. When I finally came to the point, they lowered the points because I was some camp in North Carolina and this is a camp that trains you to go to combat. And they didn't know what to do with me. I didn't want to sit and pick up cigarettes. You know, you take a stick and you pick up cigarettes and all that. I didn't want to do that. So I volunteered to go to work in one of the offices for a GI because I took typing in high school. And I got a job taking attendance of the group I was affiliated with, some camp in South Carolina. So then I got I wrote to the senator and I got the reply, we're doing everything to see that your son will get out. So the points, they dropped it and I finally got out and went back to school. And that was a big decision for me. This is 3 years, this is already starting in December. And I says, in 45. It was in December, January. Where to go? I decided I got to go back to school. What do I take up? Yeah, my mother wanted me to become a lawyer. And this is a hard decision in your life. When you're 3 years older and you're back from the war, you don't really know what you want to do. I didn't have any money. $50 a month at that day, that's what they were paying. I wasn't complaining about that, but I got to do something. My brother-in-law was an accountant. He became a CPA, and he was in the 88th Blue Devil Division, but he was a CPA when he went in, and he was a CPA when he went out, so he was very marketable. And his brother-in-law had talked to me, and he says, I think accounting is a good profession. I says, you know, every business needs an accountant to be able to keep his reports together and be able to see how he's doing. You've got to be able to accumulate your records and be able to make up financial statements and explain it to your people so they can make money. So that's the decision I had to make. I didn't want to go in. My mother wanted me to go into law. But this is from 18 to 20 years old, almost 21. I didn't want to go back to school for another 4 or 5 years. Now I'm using hindsight. I probably could have gone back into law because accounting was hard work, but I did okay. I'm here.
Yeah.
But I decided, you know, I could take in because I always was good with figures and I can get by because I went to University of Illinois and I went to Syracuse. But the 3 months at each one on this ASTP program to become an engineer. So I took chemistry, physics, and nothing to help you. But at least I had some big hours.
Yep.
So when I came back and I decided I'm going to go back to Ohio State, I decided I'll go into accounting because I'm pretty good with figures. And I don't want to spend another 2 years in learning all those laws again. And that was a big decision in my life that I didn't want to go to law school. So I went to accounting and I went to work for a restaurant chain after I finished with accounting. And then I moved to Dayton, Ohio. My brother-in-law was in Youngstown and he was already a CPA. And he agreed and we were going to go in business together, buy into it, a practice. And we had a practice for sale in Dayton, Ohio. And I said, I'm going to leave. I was with a Stowe's Grill, which had about 50 restaurants and bars throughout Ohio. And I said, well, I don't want to do that all my life. So I said, I'll go in with Jack and we'll take over this accounting practice. And we bought into it. And he got cold feet after we bought it and got the down payment done. And I went in there, I took the whole thing over for myself. I paid off the $40,000-$50,000 for the people that had the practice, and I did it. Paid them off, and I even paid my brother-in-law for the down payment he put down into the practice. Well, it's another story. But I got very involved with the counting practice. I became I became the president of the Dayton chapter of Public Accounts of Ohio. Then I got on the state level, and I was appointed by the governor to be on the county board of Ohio. That was a nice honor, right? I guess I didn't know what I had to know what party I belonged to. I had to call downtown. I says, "What do you got me listed at?" And I think it was Democrat at the time. I don't know what I even voted, but I was a Democrat. I was appointed by the governor of Ohio to be on the county board, and that's about 4,000 CPAs in Ohio, and I was one of six or seven that controlled the destiny of, and we had some interesting cases, which is another story in itself. So I practiced for 40 years in Dayton, Ohio, CPA. And then I retired, got to be 65. I'm worn out. Bev became, she went back to death to the four kids. They grew up and went their own ways. She was talked into going back, and she went back to teaching school. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it worked out. She retired, and I had retired. So,
were you involved in any veterans organizations after the war?
I was involved with the Jewish Veterans Organization in Ohio. I got involved. I got in the Dayton chapter. I became do you know the officers in any veterans organizations? Mm-hmm. There's a commander and there's a vice commander, and what's the guy who takes care of the secretary of treasury? You know, whatever that is, that's what I was in the Dayton chapter. So I did that, but that's about it. But I was very really, what I enjoyed my 40 years of practice, I was an optimist. I belonged to an optimist club.
What is an optimist club?
An optimist, if I'm going to give you the optimist creed before you leave, I must have a copy of it around here. An optimist is like the Elks, it's a service club. And our friend, the youth, and we sponsored oratorical contests every year nationally, oratorical contests. And I rose up, I was president for a year, and I remember getting speakers, and when I was president, I had always somebody had a different month, they go out and get different speakers. And I conducted the services at the lunch services every week for a whole year. Then became a past president, mm-hmm. attended a few board meetings, and I dropped out. Crowd became younger. So, but I was an optimist. I'd like to get you the optimist creed. I do remember most of it, but if I could give it for you, then I'd like you to have it. It's a good creed that we used to say it every week. Stand up and promise yourself to be so strong that nothing can disturb your peace of mind, to talk out and happiness to every person you meet. It's a good thing. It grows on you. Hmm. So I've led a pretty good life, just getting old. But I happened to be there in August the 29th, when was it? 1945. They liberated the Dachau concentration camp. Boy, that was a day. But I'm still here. Talk about it.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Melvin.
You take anything you want. You could bring it back. I'm not in a hurry. I'm going to just organize it a little more. I want you to have all the pictures. If there's anything in this book you want to use, that is the book that I read when I got from the library. And that's where I got some of these pictures from. But if you don't want it, I'm not pushing on you, but that's...
I'll see if we have it in our library, and then I'll get back
to it. Yeah, it's the...